I'm delighted to say that we're joined by Guardian and Observer football writer Amy Lawrence. Amy, how are you?
I am fine, and thank you very much for having me on. Pleasure to talk to you.
No, it's great. I mean, you know, we've asked you several times. I think both AD and myself are in awe of your work, and you know, and we love reading your stuff. So, you know, you're well, you know, it's an appreciation that we have for your work, and we do like, but we both like reading your stuff. So, you know, you're a mad keen footy fan, or sports fan generally, but footy fan specifically. Tell us about your footy supporting history.
I guess like a lot of people, it's almost a cliche, but it was not far off a fever pitch moment for me personally. I was about 6 years old when my best friend at the time, her dad had 3 season tickets at Arsenal and wanted to take his daughter. And because back in the 70s, football wasn't considered to be the number one attraction for girls, he was a bit worried that his daughter was going to hate it and get bored and drive him mad, and thought, I better take a friend. And I was the friend. So I got dragged along to Highbury and literally walked in and saw that kind of, you know, when you come through the sort of dark of the shape of the rectangle, where you see the light and the colour and the crowd and the smells and the energy and
the vivid colour of the green pitch.
Absolutely, the green and the red of the seats and the blue. It was just one of those literally overwhelming moments. I don't remember much about what I thought when I was 6 years old, but I do remember stopping in my tracks and almost feeling that whoosh of
fabulous
something overpowering you. And I just loved it straight away. And
do you remember who the opponents were that day?
Yes, it was Arsenal, Nottingham Forest. Arsenal won 3-0. And, you know, I didn't understand the offside trap there, I have to be honest.
Well, they've convoluted it now, so
offside traps enough to befuddle anyone. And it was just the whole vibe that it felt instantly like it was a place I wanted to be. Mm. So I went home and said to my parents, you know, I love football. And they kind of brushed it off and thought, yeah, all right, okay. But it stuck. So
right.
I spent most of my childhood wanting to go as often as I could. And as I got old enough, you know, being able to take myself with pocket money, which I regret that's more difficult for young football fans of today.
Mm.
That experience of being able to afford to just go wherever you want or don't go in.
Mm.
I think that football is the poorer for the fact that we've lost that. That was a big, big part of the rite of passage for a young football obsessive in the you know, 1980s, as it was for me.
Mm.
And just going around the country, watching matches, getting to buy fanzines and get a sense for what was going on at different clubs. I was fairly politically active at the time when Margaret Thatcher was trying to impose ID cards on football supporters.
God, let's not go there.
Treat us as second-class citizens.
Yeah.
It was interesting times to be a young football fan, and I threw myself into it. And I guess that kind of obsessive nature and, you know, making scrapbooks and cutting things out of the papers and studying everything, which, you know, most teenage girls weren't doing in that era, is maybe what gave me the kind of backdrop to go on to have the fortune to work in the game.
Sure. So when you first read Fever Pitch, as you mentioned earlier there, I mean, I'd imagine you read it and you thought, this is me.
Well, kind of. I mean, there were certain differences.
I mean, the Arsenal aspects of it, not the relationships part.
He's much cleverer than me. I certainly never went to Oxbridge. And, I'm not as funny or as dry or as witty as Nick Hornby is. You know, but it was a zeitgeist book for a lot of people of that era, just because, you know, it's probably quite difficult for a younger fan to realise, you know, at that kind of time, if you were a football fan, people looked down their nose at you.
Oh,
it wasn't
oh,
this
yeah.
ubiquitous social phenomenon that everybody knew about football. Even if you weren't into it, you could kind of hold a conversation about it. You knew who the most famous stars and clubs and managers were. You know, my 93-year-old grandma, God bless her, used to ring me up sometimes and, oh, that Jose Mourinho seems an awfully mean chap. And, you know, throw people into conversation in football. That kind of stuff, well, it wasn't in the general consciousness so much in the 70s and 80s. You were either a football fan or you weren't.
Mm.
And if you were, you were doing something that sounds mad today. It was not that commonplace, or was it maybe a bit risque, or, you know, it was
certainly sneered upon.
A bit more dangerous in those days, generally.
Yeah.
Not everybody's cup of tea. So I think Nick captured that, and a lot of people turned around and went, "Yes, exactly." You know,
yeah.
And we're not all thugs.
Well, quiet. Well,
we're not. Yeah, all I mean, skinhead blokes.
It was
about 20-year-old that want to go and smash up, you know, your local provincial town or whatever it is. And I felt there was something really uplifting to be able to see this thing that was a big success, this book that changed a lot of people's opinions. And it was like, look, this is why I love this game. Instead of people thinking, football, ugh, yuck.
Well, it's like football had bottomed out a little bit. I mean, in the 80s, you know, we'll remember just how... I mean, I used to go to the Goldstone Ground, and it was, you know, in the 80s, at times it was horrible. There'd be 8,000 people there, and there'll be a guaranteed ruck after the game in Hove Park. And then, you know, this was kind of then filled in with Bradford and Heysel, and then Hillsborough came along, and football was dying on its backside, and it was horrible. And then, like I say, I think that for me, the turning point was Hillsborough. And the fan movement, where you had actually intelligent, articulate fans were actually putting themselves to the fore, actually trying to reclaim the game for the rest of the fans. And I think that Nick's book came out just at the right time. That it followed 3 or 4 years later with Euro 96, and you know, sort of like the corralling of national fever, rather than sort of like it being this out of control sort of beast that you know was a shame to the country. And I think, you know, by and large, since then, we haven't really looked back. And like I say, I think your point, you use the word zeitgeist, it was, you know, it was almost a watershed moment in football fandom in this country.
I think so. And also, you know, we're in an interesting moment now where with podcasts, with blogs and vlogs and all this kind of stuff that's going on, you know, we had fanzines then. And that was really the only way of expressing that fandom in a hopefully articulate, witty, thought-provoking, passionate way. And the fanzine movement was really important for that culturally, because that gave people, ordinary fans, a voice.
Decent fans, not yet the thugs
that we'd been sort of all tarred with. Yeah, quite. And I think all of this stuff was, you know, when I think about what Brighton Hove Albion as a club means to me as a person who isn't historically a fan of the club, but who developed a strong feeling and affinity towards it, that era where you were fighting for your lives, where the Goldstone was being sold from, you know, in a despicable asset stripping way, where the fans had to be so resourceful to try and make their point, where you had Fans United, where you had people like Attila the Stockbroker, which again hooks into that idea of fanzine culture, of people being creative, of, you know, not necessarily being what in that box, in that pigeonhole, in that little box that people have put football fans in, and said, no, we're not like that. We can be clever. We can believe in positive things. We can stand up for ourselves, but not necessarily in a kind of loutish way. All of those ideas were what made that period so important, and probably is why the club is where it is right now today.
I was going to say, because I mean, it's interesting you talk about sort of the struggle that we've had, and you know, we know that what we think as Brighton fans, you know, I can, as Attila said, you know, I can raise my glass high and say with satisfaction that I was there. But I mean, I'd be curious to find out what sort of a professional journalist who, like you say, doesn't have Brighton and have Albion strictly to their heart. And when you talk about fans getting together, you know, we're talking about people who led this were an anarchist punk poet, a London chartered accountant, you know, and various people from across the whole sort of range of social life here. I'm just curious as to what, like I say, a professional journalist like yourself made of the struggle and the, you know, the 20-year battle, you know, culminating in our promotion to the Premier League.
It's just an extraordinary tale of courage, of inventiveness, of vision, of people who believed in something and wouldn't give up. You know, when you mentioned those words from Attila there about raising his glass and being there, it gave me the shivers down my neck. I'm standing here, you know, 100 or so miles away from Brighton, as you say that, and I'm struck. You know, it's very, very meaningful. It gets, I think, to the root of why we love sport, why we care about it, and why the people, you know, why we dedicate big portions of our lives to worrying about it, and thinking about it, and caring about it. You know, and a blurred line between how I can't quite just perceive that as a journalist, and I've also perceived that a lot as a football fan, and it might not be as a Brighton fan, but as someone who was, as I said, grew up to be as a passionate football supporter who cared deeply about the game, It was really, really easy to get drawn along, even as a sort of outsider to that story. And I was also there in those last couple of games at the Goldstone Ground. And to my dying, they remain real highlights of seeing the club save itself on the last day.
Yeah.
And seeing people running onto the pitch and reclaiming bits of the Goldstone Ground for themselves in that very, very difficult moment. Dick Knight in the director's box with that just that glimpse of a positive future when you're in that dark, dark tunnel, thinking that maybe, please God, around the corner, you'll get out of this mess. Yeah. It was really, really meaningful stuff that said something about the human spirit. And it's why, you know, I don't always look at football in isolation, just as the what's going on the pitch. Obviously, that's a big part of it. But this game that we love is about something bigger than that.
Sure.
And in even though the 20-year journey that you talk about, you know, it has been an extraordinary kind of, it's a beacon, it's a shining light to clubs who find themselves stricken and in difficult circumstances. But when I look at football as a whole, what concerns me is that replicating that for another club would be very, very difficult nowadays because the footballing landscape has changed.
Yeah.
Because the sort of social media world we're living in has changed. In one way, you think you should be able to rally people behind a cause more easily. But in another way, I think the way football clubs are run or allowed to be run, there's so much distance now between supporters and between the kind of the people up above or the maybe overseas owners who never even show up at their club or are completely inaccessible, or you don't know how much they care because you've never heard them speak and you can't get to them anyway. What you were able to do at Brighton by going up to Bill Archer's village in the north and having your physical process outside his house, for example, you know, it's hard to see how, I don't know, when you've got an offshore, whatever it is, that's nameless companies that are half funding. Who the hell's really funding half these clubs? I mean, we don't even know. Or they're billionaires that you're never going to get anywhere near them.
Yeah.
So it's become a bit more complex to make your voice heard properly in a funny kind of way, even though it's become easier and that anybody with a phone.
Yeah, I mean, this is where we doff our caps so much to the likes of the Charlton fans who are still fighting with their own and Blackpool. I mean, there are a lot of parallels between what happened at Brighton and what's going on at Blackpool. And we offer our solidarity. You know, I'm not saying that necessarily Valerie Bellacon is the answer. But, you know, if you can't get rid of Owen, you know, this utterly sort of horrific limpet of a leech of a family who are sucking an old and valued and loved football club dry, and the fans are tearing their hair out, you know, in order just to save something that should be a positive thing for the community and is actually just being used as a plaything for, well, pseudo mafia. That's not football. That's just spite.
No, I completely agree with you, and must be very difficult to be in that position where you have that despair, and sometimes that can lead to anger or to apathy at either ends of the scale. And trying to continue some sort of fight where you don't see an end is very, very difficult and deeply sad. And sometimes you would like to think that footballing governing bodies would have just a little bit more input in.
Don't start me on them.
Interfering. You know, with clubs that need a little bit of help.
I mean, it's one of those things you have to ask in football. What purpose does Sean Harvey serve? But, you know, I don't think that's a particular answerable question. So let's move it on to the current day here. Like I say, this is Brighton's first season in the Premier League. Well, it's not in the top division, but, you know, let's after this sort of marketing wheeze that they've invented 25 years ago, let's call it the Premier League. Now, we record, just to tell everyone, we're recording this just before the Arsenal-Man City game, which we're assuming is going ahead at the Emirates tonight. Depends on the snow. But let's look ahead to the Sunday game. Now, Brighton are playing an Arsenal. What do you make of, you know, bearing in mind that you've had a look at both sides, what do you make of the respective seasons of each club?
What's really impressed me about Brighton's season is this calmness, this steadiness with which they've tackled a new level. I think it would have been, given your history that we've discussed, it would have been quite easy to get a little bit overexcited, get a little bit over emotional to be in this company. And I think it's largely down to the personality of Chris Hughton and the kind of manager he is, mm-hmm. and the sort of atmosphere that he spreads. But no doubt, you know, there are people behind the scenes or higher up in the club who I imagine would share this kind of idea. But to try and be a bit under the radar and just carefully and in a measured way go about settling into the Premier League, I think it's been done really in really a clever and impressively calm way. Obviously, it's, you know, I think for the first few games, not scoring a goal, yeah. taking a while to get a win, you know, it would have been easy to worry a little bit. But, you know, I think that Chris Hughton had the confidence that it would come good. And I think it's overall, it's been a really very respectable season thus mm-hmm. far. And obviously the job needs to be finished in terms of staying up. Certainly the platform has been built over these last few weeks mm-hmm. And never really panicking if things have been, you know, haven't quite gone well for a period of time. So I'm really impressed with that. And I'd be fairly confident that it's going to end well, but I mean, you want to get as many points as possible, I guess, over the next few weeks.
Absolutely.
Because the end could be particular, and set of fixtures look quite daunting potentially.
It's quite
I think also overcoming the fact that the squad wasn't perfectly balanced at the start of the season in terms of strikers, at least.
Yes, you know, it was very lightweight.
I did worry. I looked at the first few games and thought, I don't know where the goal is coming from. And you know, it needed January to address that, and to have not got under too much pressure having that first half of the season without a really strong source of goals available is probably a testament to how the whole team has kind of got their act together. Mm-hmm. But you know, I would hope that the firepower that's been recruited will make an impact over these next few weeks.
So what do you make of Arsenal's season so far, bearing in mind the pressures that there are on, you know, totally different pressures there are on a club like that?
I think it's just a complicated time for the club, and that's borne out on the pitch. This is probably the least consistent Arsenal team I can remember in decades. Most of the Wenger years, there's been periods of the season where they've put a good little run together that would be a good few weeks of wins that can suddenly get everyone optimistic, get the confidence back and so on. But if you look at this season, it just seems to have been so stop start. I don't look like they look feel like they've ever really got going this season. Too many performances have been flat or error prone. The team just has that feeling of being a little bit dysfunctional. You can kind of nitpick on various areas of the team and say the goalkeeping situation. Both Petacek and David Ospina look to be not quite at the highest level that you would want in a world-class keeper, and that Cech looks like he's just gone past that point of being on top of his game, which happens to all keepers when they get older. Mm-hmm. Defensively, you know, most games there's a few heart-stopping moments in there, and it's a question of whether the opposition capitalise. The midfield hasn't been balanced for a long time, but the club really wants for a kind of physical dominant force in midfield. They just don't have a player like that to give them the balance. And up front, they've broken their record on strikers. I mean, I'm sure this will probably feel like a lot of money for Brighton. The kind of money available to try and
get an entire stadium front, for most squads, you know,
nearly £50 million for Lacazette, and then a bit more than that again for Aubameyang.
Mm.
But it's interesting and very telling that neither of them have had fabulous starts to their Arsenal career, because they just don't seem to be getting a huge amount of service because the team is just not playing terribly well. So, and that, you know, that it has a knock-on effect of denting your kind of instinctive confidence as a striker to make those right runs and to hit something early, or the kind of things that when you're feeling good as a centre forward, you're creating and finding and taking chances more naturally. So, yeah, they're obviously behind the scenes, there's all sorts of
stuff, yeah,
vibes, a lot of which are lying at the door of a long, long-term manager.
Is he off?
And it just feels like, I don't know. I mean, it's if anybody knew, they'd, you know, they'd be stupid not to put a lot of money on it. But it's his future is entwined. Really, there's only two people involved in the situation about whether Wenger stays or goes. You know, there can be tens of thousands of fans against it. There can be the players who have had enough. There can be half the board might be thinking, or have already been thinking for some time, that they want a change. But in the end, Arsene Wenger looks in the mirror. If he wants to stay, stays. If he wants to go, he's going to be the person that makes that call.
Yeah.
And the only other person who has an influence is Stan Kroenke, who is the American billionaire majority shareholder, whose kind of hours of interest in Arsenal Football Club over the year don't tot up to very much, I would guess. That's the evidence that suggests so anyway.
Sure.
So, while he seems to be quite happy with the bank account details.
Yeah, quiet.
He seems to be not interested in particularly questioning whether there's a change in the management. So while lots of things can point to it making sense, unless either Arsene Wenger or Stan Kroenke want to bite that particular bullet, it ain't happening.
Sure. Okay, here on Radio Reverb, it's Reverbathon Day, and we always have the Reverbathon the closest day to International Women's Day, which is March the 7th. Amy, I mean, without wishing to sound tokenistic, I mean, obviously, you're a female journalist working in a predominantly male environment. How do you find working within that sphere?
I can honestly say that in the best part of 25 years of working in this job, the times when there's been some sort of issue that's maybe been a complicated or made me feel uncomfortable are so minuscule. I've never made an issue of it, and I've very, very seldom felt it to be an issue. When I started out, maybe it was because I was quite young and impressionable and didn't really take that much notice of things. I don't know what people said behind my back, that's for sure. I was just ecstatic to be given this opportunity to be wandering around inside football grounds and talking to people in the game, that if there was any bad vibes, I sort of probably just bounced off me. And I found most people, you know, you find the odd person that was a little bit dubious, shall we say. But I've always been a really, really strong believer that if you have passion for your subject and knowledge for your subject and enthusiasm for your subject, that can get you quite a long way. And usually, if anybody was happy to give me the time of day to chat about football, that enthusiasm and, you know, hopefully enough knowledge and passion came through pretty strong. So usually it didn't take long to have a chat with someone about football and for them to realise that it wasn't so bad to talk about football to someone who wasn't a bloke.
So the issues...
I never felt it was a huge issue, I must say.
So the issues, such as there might have been, would have been with the fella rather than, say, with yourself. I mean, it's not as though you've ever felt uncomfortable then.
No, I mean, I was really, really early into my career. It was probably in the early to mid-90s. I remember going to do something up at Manchester City and Bernard Manning was there. Oddly, do you remember Bernard Manning?
Yeah, I met him
who
once.
Was a bit of a kind of Man City sort of... mascot of sorts. He was sort of their select fan of the era before, you know, Oasis and all that kind of stuff came along. And, you know, he obviously told a whole host of unpolitically correct, excruciating jokes, which is how he made his
stock
name.
In trade, yeah.
And, you know, all the good blokes guffawed along and I just thought, oh God, this is awful. But I mean, it wasn't a particularly big deal. I can't pretend to be upset about it. And but I do remember at some point there was an opportunity to go and talk to some of the players in the changing rooms, and so suddenly they thought, "Oh, this isn't going to work." Like, well, you know, I'm afraid you can't come in, Amy. You can't come in the dressing room. So all the chaps marched off, and I sat outside and felt like, you know, a little bit annoyed to be left out.
Yeah.
But I mean, you know, and then that was that. And then the guys came out and told me what was said, and it wasn't a big deal. But right. You can get as upset about these things as you wish to. You can get offended by something like that if you want. But I could understand why it wasn't considered appropriate for a 23-year-old, you know, young reporter, female reporter, to go into a changing room. So I wasn't going to take it particularly personally. It didn't really impact on my ability to do my job.
Heaven forfend that you should misbehave.
But well, there is.
Or quite.
Yeah, but no. I mean, and then I have another vague memory from a similar era of there being a press junket where we got to play at Wembley, at the old Wembley, under the Twin Towers.
Yeah.
In some sort of tournament, they must have been about to rip up the pitch or something. And I was really excited. I mean, I'm a terrible footballer. That's important to point out.
You and everyone else.
That wasn't really the point. The point was we got to go and have a kick about on the turf. And I remember turning up, and all the guys went into the, you know, the legendary Wembley changing rooms.
Mm.
And of course, for similar reasons, it was like, well, you know, you better go and find a ladies' loo somewhere, love, sort of thing.
Yeah.
So I went and got changed into my stuff and went and met everybody else. And Graham Taylor, the old head of the FA of the time, Graham Kelly, noticed that I was going to play and reeled out some old FA rule that you weren't allowed to have mixed football.
Oh, crying out loud.
Above the age of, I don't know, 10 or whatever it was, you know, like kiddie football.
Yeah.
And so he wanted me to not to take part in this ridiculous kind of, you know, kick about in front of like two people. But to be fair, a few of my peers turned around and said, well, that's not on. If she can't play, we're not playing.
Absolutely.
And had to bow down.
Absolutely. I'll tell you
really see little things. But if that's the kind of stuff I can remember, if that's as bad as it gets, then you know that there isn't really a problem.
I'm with you. I mean, that's Graham Kelly's story there. I mean, that's kind of indicative of, you know, his attitude to the Albion from 20 years ago. I mean, he did bugger all. The only person at the FA that helped us out in those days was David Davis. So in which case, is there any advice that you could give to a girl or a young woman who actually wants to take up sports journalism?
Well, I mean, it's probably the advice that I would give to anybody. I don't think it's a gender issue. I think one of the great things about football now is that, you know, there are a lot of opportunities to work in the game that perhaps didn't exist 15, 20 years ago, just by virtue of the fact that the game and all the surrounding accoutrements has mushroomed to be such a gigantic thing.
Mm.
So if you want to work at a club, you know, there's marketing, there's media, there's commercial aspects, there's being, you know, physio, there's data analysis, there's so many roles that are not gender specific roles, that if you're you know, if you've got a talent for something, an interest in a particular element, and you know, your love for football is unquenchable, and will hopefully give you that extra boost, and you have qualities. You know, I'm a big believer in meritocracy. If you're good at something and you deserve to have a chance, then have that chance. All the rest is gubbins, you know. So just do the best that you can do in your chosen field. And if you want to try and get into a football club or an association, then why not? I recently had a very, very interesting pleasure to go over to the French Football Federation and meet an interesting lady called Corinne Diacre, who is the coach of the French women's team. She caused quite a stir not so long ago when she became the first woman, or certainly one of the first women, to coach a professional men's team, Clermont in France, which she did for 3 seasons. And when I was there, they said to me, oh, while you're here, there's a few other people that you might be interested in meeting. And it turns out that the French Football Federation, 40% of the people that they employ and are women.
Wow.
That's quite a high percentage for a football federation. Mm. And within that 40%, a very good number of them are in really senior roles.
Okay.
Not just, you know, in some sort of assistant something somewhere, you know, sitting in behind a computer doing nothing. The number two of the French Football Federation, the vice president, So if, you know, anything happens to the president at the, you know, while it's during the World Cup or whatever, the person who is going to be there to answer any question or make any decision is a woman. The CEO, who's basically been the brains behind the whole strategic development of French football in the last few years and who is incredibly smart and highly regarded, is also a woman. So I just thought that that was quite a good example. And their attitude was, again, look, if, you know, we're good at our jobs, we got, you know, someone believed in us enough to give us this opportunity, I'm going to do my best to show that I'm not a token, I'm not special, I'm just, I'm here because I should be. And that's the way that they're treated. So that was something that kind of gave me, well, hopefully that kind of message is a positive one for anybody. Just get good at what you do and then try and get into football, because I think the opportunities are there.
Amy Lawrence, thank you very much indeed for joining us on the Albion Roar.
Absolute pleasure.